Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The largest annual book festival in the entire state of North Carolina is free, open to the public, and in downtown Winston-Salem. Yep, Bookmarks is gearing up for its 10th annual Festival of Books and Authors with a veritable who's who list of best-selling authors in every category and for all ages. And did you know that for years now, Cirque du Soleil has turned to the Triad for the lion's share of its design and production talent? Though it's true, the University of North Carolina School of the Arts and Cirque are like this. Why, they've even got a little tag team thing going on next month that you can see for yourself live on the UNCSA campus. It's called Circus Theater Project, and wait till you hear and see what these all-student productions have in store this year. And for a sample of what's to come at Bookmarks 2014, author Meg Medina and our own Bethany Chafin tackle the subject of teen bullying in Meg's award-winning novel. Do you know the title? It's a good one. Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass. Next, after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got a little taste of Cirque du Soleil for you on the show today. It's in our own backyard, and believe you me, it's going to be good. That's coming up next, but first, Bethany Chafin is going to get all kinds of bookish on us.
I'm Bethany Chafin. Meg Medina is one of the 40 writers to be featured at the Bookmark's 10th Annual Festival of Books and Authors, to be held on September 6th. Her most recent novel, Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, is this year's recipient of the Bora Belpre Award. The award is presented to a Latino or Latina writer and illustrator whose work best portrays, affirms, and celebrates the Latino cultural experience in an outstanding work of literature for children and youth. Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass follows 15-year-old Pity Sanchez as she navigates the social, emotional, and physical effects of bullying. Meg Medina spoke with me from her home in Virginia, and she began by telling me about embracing her writing career.
What ended up happening is that I lacked the courage to sort of decide that I was going to be a writer. So I did sort of peripheral things. I wrote press releases. I wrote articles in local magazines and local press. And then something happened, I think, the year that I turned 40. I had been teaching writing. I had done all these things around writing, but never had kind of decided that I was going to sit down and write a novel. And around the time that I turned 40, I was working at a school, writing there, publicity materials and so on, and I quit my job. I came home and I said to my husband, Javier, guess what? I quit my job today, and I am going to write a novel. And we had young children then, and I'm sure Javier was thinking that we were going to starve to death, but to his eternal credit, he just said, you know, when you jump out of the plane, the next thing to do is pull the cord on the chute. He said, so, you know, pull the cord. He said, I think you can do it. And that's how I got started. But I can't say exactly what drove me to it. But I can say that all those years leading up to becoming, to sitting down and actually writing a novel for children, I was afraid of not making it. I was afraid of stepping into a career that in some way didn't seem responsible or secure. But what I found out since, of course, is not doing it really wasn't going to be an option. I wasn't ever really going to be happy at any job until I really did the one that I was meant for. And in this case, it's writing for kids. I think once the first book was bought, and the first book was Milagros, Girl from Away, once that book got bought and made itself, you know, through out into the world, I couldn't stop. The stories were all there, and I just kept writing and kept going. And, you know, not every book comes out to huge critical acclaim. Not every book comes out to enormous sales. But every book that I send out there, I send out with a real feeling of peace and satisfaction that I put everything I had into it that was available to me at that time. It's sort of like sending your kids out, really, into the world, to be honest with you. Like, when they go away, you did the very best that you could for them, and you send them out there in the hope that they'll do good. And I do the same thing, really, with my books. So with this most recent one, certainly, in particular, Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, I have, you know, it's been very well received, and it's done good. It's opened some conversation in schools, among librarians, among adults, among young people, and that sort of fuels me to write the next book and the one after that.
How did you decide that this book was going to address the subject of bullying? I've read that, unfortunately, it's something that you were familiar with when you were growing up and perhaps a teenager. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I was I did have someone approach me in the schoolyard in the seventh grade. I was a little younger than the protagonist in this novel, with the same line, so-and-so is going to kick your ass. And my reaction was, who is that? I had no idea. You know, I grew up in Queens, New York, and it was kind of a rough school, and I came face-to-face, really, with being targeted for no reason that I could really understand or see by a bully. And what I remember of the experience is the fear, of course, of going to school, and then the really awful ways that it got at all parts of my life until I stopped wanting to go to school. I tried to become a very hardened sort of person. It just got at how I saw myself. And it took years, really, for me to feel better, to be honest with you, because by that time, you know, I had been, you know, I stopped liking school, liking people, like detached from my family. It just swirled into this horrible funnel cloud. And when I sat down to write the novel, you know, it was originally a short story. It was going to be an anthology, and the topic of the anthology is going to be the work of Latina writers working today, and the theme was Latinas at a turning point. And so when I was thinking about turning points, you know, we sometimes think of turning points as really joyous things, right, that happen to us, but you also have really awful turning points. And in my life, that really was a terrible time, because as a kid, I had been fairly stable and happy. I mean, I went to the Girl Scout. I went to the Glee Club. I did all of those things that we do and had friends, sleepovers, that kind of thing in elementary school. And then I hit this buzzsaw, and all of that changed for me, compounded, of course, by just the fact that being a teen, you know, physically and every other way is hard. So I sat down and I tried to write the story as the experience really felt to me. All of the events in the book, of course, are fabricated in terms of the people in the building and who the bully was. Like, all of those things are the product of my imagination. But what is 100% true in the novel is how it feels to be on the receiving end and to feel so lost and have no good escape, no real way to handle this. And when I was on the receiving end, it was during school, and even that, you know, bled into my personal life. But today, kids are bullied 24 hours, and it spreads quickly with the use of electronics. And so there's this feeling that you can't escape, that you've been hit by this enormous tsunami, right? You can't fight against it. And I think that is the feeling that we see in kids that end up making really terrible and sad decisions about how they're going to deal with this. So I was really just writing the truth. I wasn't really interested in tying up the package pretty. I wasn't interested in making people be friends. I wasn't interested in moralizing about the situation. I wanted to just paint it and let people look.
What's fascinating about your book is that, honestly, the character of Yaqui, the bully, she only appears in a few scenes, actually, yeah. You know, physically, and yet she's present on almost every page and for the reader. And you realize that that is exactly how your protagonist is feeling. And so I thought that was done really, really well.
What I hope happens with the novel, the good I hope this novel does, is that it opens up honest conversation. And that's really hard. I mean, schools want to put up posters that say bully-free zone. They want to you know, they want to put up, you know, have assemblies about treating each other kindly. They want to handle it as best they can, but sometimes they really shy away from tough conversations.
You created two older women in her life, her mother and then Leela, who are representing kind of two sides of the coin of sexuality. You know, Leela is very open and very just sensual and expressive. And you can see that Pity's mother has sort of suppressed some of that. But one of my favorite scenes in the book is when Pity walks into the kitchen and she's, maybe you can describe it, I'm sure you can describe it better than I can, but she sees her mother moving to the rhythm of the music.
Yeah.
And yeah. I wonder, you know, did you write those women in to sort of serve any sort of function, or were they just kind of natural characters that felt right?
You know, I populate my novels with people, with the women I knew growing up, versions of them, you know, collapsed into a new character. But it was really important to me to create the world of Latina women as I know it from the inside. And so if you look carefully at that novel, there are business women. There are women who are working at, you know, beginning jobs, you know, like Ma and Atronica. There are sensual women. There are extremely practical women. There are people who are bragging. There are people who are embracing. There's everybody in there. And I really wanted to create a colorful and warm world for her, because that's what exists, and I think that's really important for all kids to see, certainly for Latino kids to see, and they'll recognize it, I'm sure. They'll see their aunts and their grandmothers and their mothers there, but it's really important for everybody to see the diversity that's within the Latino community and what it really is. With regard to Leela and Ma, they are very natural to me. I loved that they were best friends. Interestingly, right? An odd couple in some ways, and then in some ways so perfectly suited to each other, because they're both so fiercely loyal and so pure-hearted, really. It's just that one fights the world with a broken plunger handle, and the other with her, you know, tart tongue and her sense of pride. In real life, we're all interconnected. In real life, we can look to the people around us who love us to help us make good decisions and to help us have the strength to dig out of a hole.
Well, on the subject of strong women in whatever way they choose to express that strength, you work on a blog called The Girls of Summer, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners about that project.
Oh, that's one of my favorite projects of all. Girls of Summer is a blog that my friend and I began 4 years ago. My friend is Gigi Amato. She's also an author with Candlewick. At the time, our daughters were getting ready to leave high school, and we were really feeling sad and about losing them somehow. Like, we were excited they were moving on, but also a little sad. And we got to talking about how books had helped us raise them. Even from the time, like, you're pregnant, what to expect when you're pregnant, what to expect the first year, you know, how to help your toddler, this. And then storybooks and the novels that we read with them, or novels that helped us be better mothers, all of that kind of stuff. And we ended up asking ourselves, I wonder if we could pick, you know, 18 books, one for every year of their lives, that we think really celebrate what the journey was from going from this little bundle all the way to these young women who are about to step out on their own. And we did. And so we made this blog, and we picked the books, and then we had, every Friday we have a new author from the list do a Q&A with us. Even more fun is that we have used this project in the city of Richmond, where we both live, to really engage people and to sort of move through the world as literary citizens, so to speak. They're just the books that we really love that when we read them, we go, oh, yes, this is what I would want my daughter to know. I'd want my daughter to know this girl.
Obviously, it's difficult to choose 18, so maybe this isn't a fair question. But when you were growing up, was there a book or maybe two books that were really helpful to you in your adolescence?
Oh, in adolescence, it's a whole other thing. I'll tell you some of them along the way. My favorite of all time is Charlotte's Web. And I say that because it's a book about friendship and sacrifice for friendship and loyalty. And I love those themes. And I grew up in Queens, as far away from a farm as you could imagine. I had no notions about pigs or farm animals or any such thing. And he spoke across all of that to me. Mm-hmm. And I love that story. I love it still. As I moved through high school back then, of course, I jumped a lot directly into adult books, and I read some crazy things that I probably shouldn't have at that age, or that would have made my mother's hair just stand on end. I'm sure I found a copy of Valley of the Dolls and, you know, Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. I found all those books and read them. I remember Go Ask Alice, and I remember reading it tucked into my social studies book during class. It was comparative government back in the time when we spent a lot of time talking about the USSR versus the U.S. System of government, and there it was, Go Ask Alice Inside. But really the book that changed everything for me after that was The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. Mm. And that came out in the 80s. I was already in my early 20s then. But that was the first book that I noticed. There were books before, I'm sure, but that was the first book I noticed written in English about people that sounded like my family. Mm-hmm. And I'm not Mexican. My family background is from Cuba. But that neighborhood, those tías and tíos, the use of phrases that were exactly right, it was so eye-opening and so comforting and so life-changing for me. Yeah. I think that changed everything, because I think that book opened up for me the possibility that what I was living was worthy of story.
Wow.
And that's why I'm such a huge advocate of multicultural literature. I think we deserve to read everybody's story, right? Every kid should have that experience of reading books from behind another set of eyeballs. But in addition to that, the power of seeing yourself in the pages of a book is it's almost without description the impact that it can make in a kid's life.
Meg Medina is the author of Yaqui Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass. She will be participating in Bookmark's 10th Annual Festival of Books and Authors on September 6th. At 11, she will be discussing the topic of bullying and young adult literature with writer Len Vlahos in the Art Gallery of the Haynes Brands Theater. And at 1 p.m. that day, Meg will be presenting the Spanish-English Storytime in Winston Square Park. For links to Meg's blog, more information on her books, and the We Need Diverse Books campaign, visit our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
That was Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and we're going to take off our reading glasses for a minute and get set for Fun at the Circus. Circus Theater Project at UNCSA, to be more precise. After 9 months of careful planning, rehearsals, collaboration with faculty, and Cirque du Soleil, these incredibly talented young artists are ready to share their work with the world next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Nishoku presents a young boy and his escape from the reality of his own broken home. He creates an imaginary world where he's called upon to teach the sun and moon to coexist in harmony before the earth is destroyed. Red Balloon draws from Japanese no theater in showing how an orphan boy rediscovers the beauty of childhood. Circus Theater Project, the unique collaboration between Cirque du Soleil and their longtime partner, University of North Carolina School of the Arts, is now in its third season. You see, years ago, Cirque had used UNCSA's campus for the site of their design and production conferences, and they were, shall we say, impressed with what they saw. So, to keep the Cirque du Soleil pipeline full of young talent, a few years ago, they approached UNCSA and set up the Circus Theater Project. It allows students in all schools, dance, design and production, drama, filmmaking, music, and visual art, to explore their own ideas and creative processes as a team. And today, after months of rehearsals, consultations, evaluations, and refinement, these all student-run productions are ready to share with the world. UNCSA School of Drama student actor Alex Bodine and UNCSA School of Dance alumnus, contemporary dancer Emily Chamberlain, spoke with me about Circus Theater Project, and they were joined by UNCSA Director of Scenic Design and Circus Theater Project Director John Coyne.
Well, one of the things that I love about the Circus Theater Project is that we bring together students from all the different schools at the School of the Arts. So we've got film, dance, drama, design and production, and music students. And the students all work together on the productions throughout the year, but in very kind of defined roles. And the Circus Project really kind of breaks that down and lets the students explore what they're interested in. And we try very hard to put together teams of different students from different schools and possibly students who don't even know each other. And so what I love about that is I get to see these great collaborations happen, these great friendships develop in ways that may not have happened during the school year. I think it's a real opportunity for the students to get to know other creative collaborators that they may not have known. And it's really fun to see that develop and happen throughout the year for me.
Has it impacted you personally or outside of work in any way or no?
Yeah, no, it has. I mean, I'm in charge of the scene design program. So, you know, I'm a set designer myself. And so my role at the school is defined in a certain way. And again, just working with students from dance or from film, you know, people that I don't even normally deal with, it certainly opens up how the creative process can work for different people. I think that's really useful to see and participate in. So for me, I'm learning all the time from these students. You know, it certainly shows different ways of working and what interests other people and their, you know, depending on their background and their own training. You know, it certainly has an impact on me showing, oh, there are a lot of ways to go about coming at a creative project.
And we've got two representatives here from the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in contemporary dance. Yeah. We have Emily Chamberlain. And from the School of Drama, we have Alex Bodine. Alex, in the School of Drama, what are some of the strengths of the program that you've experienced so far?
The faculty is the huge strength of the School of Drama. We've got just masters of the acting craft working with us every day. Bob Francesconi working with his mask system that he developed. Great singing teachers, Janine Hawley and Greg Walter, wonderful acting teachers, Tanya Belov with her Chekhov technique and Caroline Kava with her Meisner technique, Matt Bullock, just wonderful faculty members.
And leading the charge, you've got a guy by the name of Carl Forsman.
Yeah, we've got a new dean, Mr. Carl Forsman. He's pretty great. He brings a lot of new life to the school.
Alex, so what does the Circus Theater Project give you as a young professional coming in through the ranks that the School of Drama per se does not offer? What do you get out of this program that's unique and that you find useful?
What's really unique about the Circus Theater Project is I've always wanted to pursue directing, not as what I want to do with my life per se, but I've always wanted to dive into productive art, art that I'm making rather than just art that I'm participating in. Circus Theater Project really provided a structure for that to happen. I mean, I've had ideas and never had like the courage to go and pursue them before. And Circus Theater Project really is giving me training wheels because it's putting me with a whole collaborative team to make this project work. And it's helped build my confidence as a director and a productive artist.
And Emily, contemporary dance, tell me about your role within the context of the Circus Theater Project. Is it choreography or as a dancer participant or both? How does it work?
Well, as the Circus Theater Project is a big collaborative project, I am titled Artistic Collaborator. So me and my team members, we all come from different backgrounds and different areas. I come from contemporary dance, where choreographing has been part of my training, and drama comes from, you know, their own knowledge and background. So when we come together, we all offer what we've learned through school. So up to this point, I've been gearing towards more of the choreographic side of things, but still as an artistic collaborator with my team.
One of the challenges that we give with the Circus Theater Project is that there can be no recognizable language. And this was a criteria, if you will, that Cirque du Soleil set up from the beginning. And so I think the whole exercise is, how do you go about telling a story without words? And the students do that, obviously, through movement, through sound, through bodies in space, through the lights, through the costumes, or all kinds of means. But it's been fun to watch. This is our third year, and I think, you know, they're still exploring, how do you do that? How do we create this non-traditional means of storytelling? And, you know, sometimes it's actually through silence. You know, that's a piece last year employed that, and it was really quite powerful. Sometimes it is through full orchestration and, you know, chaotic movement and, you know, filling the stage. But sometimes what I've found is just a really simple moment where two characters connect and we observe that can be quite powerful. So, you know, there are all kinds of different ways to do it. And that's what I enjoy in seeing, you know, how the students are exploring that.
As you alluded to earlier, Alex, it seems like the opportunities that this project presents would be tough to turn down. So, in other words, who wouldn't want to have their circus theater project produced? But I know everybody can't do it. Talk about the audition process and getting into it.
The gateway process... I was laughing about this yesterday with one of my collaborators. We started 9 months ago on this process.
Wow.
And now at the end of our nine-month pregnancy, we're about to give birth to this circus theater project.
I didn't even look at it that way.
It was really interesting because it started with so many ideas. In our team, I'm sure there are a lot of ideas across the board, but just so many ideas that we were trying to fit into a six-minute piece. And as things boiled down, the piece became more and more real. And I feel like as the time went on, like, I guess, a pregnancy, the idea of the piece became more real and we became more invested in it. And as we became more invested in it, our plans for it became more sophisticated. Our story became more sophisticated. The way we decided to tell our story became more specific, more meaningful, while losing a lot of things that weren't necessary.
Give me a day in the life. At this stage in production now, Emily, what can you walk us through? I mean, even the demographics of getting people together.
There's a lot of different mediums in our piece. There's dance, there's gesture, there's props, that we've combined all these different areas, which require a lot of rehearsal to really understand and be comfortable with. When you've been with something so long and at a point throughout the gateways, you know, each gateway, they would have people there who would give us feedback. And at a point, you had to clarify and defend your idea, know that it's worth getting together for. In each new gateway, they would want to see results. They'd want to see that you'd thought and you'd come up with something new. So that along the way has really invested me in this process.
Let's talk a little bit about the Circus Theater Works in Progress. And I guess we'll begin with Nishoku.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the Nishoku story, just a little backstory for starters, Emily.
So Nishoku is about a young boy who journeys out of his reality in through his imagination. So he's coming from a home situation with arguing parents, pretty much, and that his way of escaping and traveling out is to go on an adventure, first with the embodiment of the moon, this womanly moon who takes him into outer space through comets and stars and space, until the sun embodiment decides to enter in. And each of these characters have their own relationship with this boy in his imaginary world. And we're entering the relationship of the moon and the sun, where at a time when they don't know how to exist in harmony, sunrise and sunsets are not something that's happening yet, that they haven't found a way to revolve around the earth kindly. So our story is how that piece is found and the boy's role between the two and his relationship with them through his imagination.
So how was your first Gateway presentation? Mm-hmm. What did they sign off on? What did they say? What did you present on that first Gateway?
We didn't have the idea of the storyline yet. Definitely not. We had all these little elements. We said, we have these beautiful silks that we're playing with. They move really pretty. Like, let me show you how they move. And so we did that, and we knew we wanted to play with silks in our hands. And then we also played with embodiments of the moon and sun.
Yep. You guys really started with the ingredients of the story, but they didn't really have the story yet, especially at the beginning. And the story, I think, for your team came kind of later, not till I think the third Gateway or so, or it was starting to form maybe the second Gateway. But they kept wanting to work with the sun and the moon. That was the theme.
Yes.
And then different elements that could work with that, like fish and comets and,
yes,
you know, outer space. And at some point you had flowers and different things. So, you know, it was kind of all these elements. And I think they had to discover what the story was around those elements.
So a good bit of imagination used on the part of the judges.
And what they showed was compelling. I mean, the imagery was beautiful, you know, so we definitely knew there was something there. But we kept asking, well, what's the story, you know? And so then eventually I think they got to that, and it's pretty exciting to see.
Alex, I want to ask you to take us back to the early beginnings of Red Balloon, that first Gateway. What did they see? What did the faculty see?
The first meeting that Kenny, Garrett, and I had, none of us were really sure how to start, and so Garrett just came up and said, well, here is a style of theater that I've seen a lot, done a lot, and I really want to play with, and it's the Kuroko style from Japanese no theater. Stagehands, essentially, all in black, that move things around on stage so you get machine-like effects, but people are making them happen. If you've seen videos of like the Scissor Sisters, or there's this great Japanese game show called Charades, the style is farcical and cartoon-like, but you have some really fun things happening on stage that you couldn't just make happen.
Give me an example.
Okay. We've got at one point our character jumping up to a window that just flies in, and his reflection shows up in the window, and they have some fun mirroring things happening, and then his reflection does something different because it's in a dream, so the reflection goes and does its own thing. But at the same time, we've got the reflection of the whole street behind him in the window as well. So we've got movers interacting with what's going on in the New York City street while the main action's happening as well. It's a whole stage picture that's built.
Break down the story for me. The Red Balloon, what's this little boy up to?
So it's the story of this little boy who just lost his mother and has had to grow up prematurely because of that, and has faced a lot of hardship because of that. And inspired by a random act of kindness by a little girl he meets on the street, he has this dream that reminds him what it's like to be a little kid and full of hope and courage. And in the end, he's still in the same situation, but he now has a new friend and is just remembering what it's like to live life a little more easily, I guess.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Dance alumnus, contemporary dancer Emily Chamberlain, UNCSA School of Drama student, actor Alex Bodine, and they were joined by UNCSA Director of Scenic Design and Circus Theater Project Director John Coyne. Circus theater performances are Friday night, August 22nd at 7 o'clock, and Saturday, August 23rd at 2 and 7 in the DeMille Theater on the UNCSA campus. You'll find links to ticket information at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now. When we return, Bookmark's Executive Director Ginger Hendricks will be on hand to hold our hands through this fall's Festival of Books and Authors. More than 40 best-selling and award-winning authors in all, and they cover a lot of territory next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Bookmark's free Festival of Books and Authors is coming up September 6th in Winston-Salem, with 40 authors presenting their work, signing books, and answering questions. Among them will be Wake Forest University alumna Emily Giffen, whose just published sixth book was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. The Color of Water author and musician James McBride will discuss his new novel, The Good Lord Bird, about American Revolutionary John Brown. Author-illustrator Edward Hemingway, grandson of Ernest, will be here too, and author Karen Abbott will share her spellbinding true story of four women in the Civil War, a socialite, farm girl, abolitionist, and a widow who were all spies. This is the 10th annual Festival of Books and Authors. For the past 5 years, it's been organized by Executive Director Ginger Hendricks.
We got to a really exciting point. We had been down in the Arts District for 5 years, and we outgrew it. We actually were needing venues that were 200 people and larger, could hold these larger audiences with our bigger names that we were bringing in. So it's going to be a great place for us. So we'll be in the Milton Road Center for the Arts. We'll be in Haynes Brands Theater. We'll be in Winston Square Park, which can hold over 400 people. We'll be in another smaller venue called the Downtown Stage, which will be right there on Holly Street. And then we'll be in Spruce Street surrounding it with exhibitors and food trucks and information booth will be there and all kinds of chances to meet authors as well as some of our sponsors and other folks that are interested in literacy.
Ginger, this year, as in years past, you're inviting, these are world-renowned authors, and many of them are New York Times best-selling authors. What does it mean? I hear that term bandied about all the time, but what does it mean to be a New York Times best-selling author? What are the criteria?
To be a New York Times best-selling author, it is, of course, the New York Times, which keeps track of all of the different books that are sold. And so each week, all the bookstores and all the folks in the country that qualify to be New York Times best-selling stores report how many books they've sold. And that's all compiled. And then that's where you get the New York Times lists that are done in, they're published in the Winston-Salem Journal as well as other places online and things like that. They also mean that they may be a New York Times best-selling author, or they may be a number one New York Times best-selling author. And that's when they actually have sold so many books that they're number one, meaning that they sold the most books in the country in that category.
I want to get into some of these authors and showcase just a few of them, because there are so many to go. How many authors total are we looking at?
Just a little over 40 this year. 40 authors, so 40 different schedules.
Wow.
40 different events and things like that. And some of them will come together and do, you know, speak with two or three when we have like our panel discussions or our workshops and things like that as well.
Let's begin with a Wake Forest University alumna and Emily Giffen. And we were talking about New York Times bestsellers lists earlier. 11 million copies of Emily's books are in print worldwide. An amazing output. What strikes you most about Emily's writing style?
I think with Emily, she's one of these people that you just want to sit down and have lunch with and just talk. You know, you just automatically love the characters. You love her writing style and that she is clear and she's descriptive. And so we're really excited to be able to bring her back to Winston-Salem, not only for her fame with the new book, which is number one on the New York Times bestseller list right as of now, but also just the popularity she's had with their other books being turned into movies.
Something Borrowed hit theaters in 2011, starring Kate Hudson and John Krasinski. And the new novel, The One and Only, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list. Is that from preprint sales? How does that work?
It is. So it's from, a lot of times they'll do pre-sales. And so this is something that we'll be doing at the festival this year as well. So if a book has not quite come out yet, then you can pre-buy it and then it's either sent to you or picked up.
How are you able to recruit such well-known writers, and what sort of feedback have you received from writers who have appeared at Bookmark's festivals in the past?
We're able to find them, but it's very competitive. And so what we do is in October, usually it's the day after the festival, we start with the wish list. And with it being our 10-year anniversary, we really wanted to think big, really big. And so what we do with all of these authors, and probably another 100 that it doesn't work out with, we write letters and we explain why they want to come to Winston-Salem, why they want to be a part of this festival. It may be a connection like Emily Giffen or L.M. Elliott, who are their Wake Forest graduates. It may be that they have taught in North Carolina before and they love North Carolina and want to come back and visit friends or family. Or it may be because we are now the largest annual book festival and we try to show them why they should come to Winston-Salem. And so one of the things that we're really the most interested in is we're looking at authors that have had a book published within the last year, sometimes within the last 6 months. And actually from our list this year, several authors, their books are coming out within 2 weeks of the festival. So that again adds some excitement. So we're on a book tour usually with most of these authors. So we work with publicists at the different publishing houses and we try to get them to want to send an author to us. We have a committee that meets and talks through it. We don't want to have 10 mystery authors, for instance, or even 5 romance or what have you. We have to think about what our group wants. What does Winston-Salem and beyond? We now are representing almost 50 counties in North Carolina and 12 states last year. So we're looking at what they are interested in as well. And we really are also thinking about offering something for everyone. So we want to have, you know, a whole family come and be able to enjoy it. So that's why we have, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning historian. We have National Book Award winners. We have Coretta Scott King winners. We have also, you know, programs in Spanish and in English. And we even have Rick Riley this year, who we're really excited about, who has the ESPN and Sports Illustrated fame. So for those dads or moms who are huge fans of sports, they'll really enjoy hearing him speak.
And dads and moms with young adult readers will be happy to see some authors on the horizon there and young readers as well. Books for children and illustrations.
Absolutely.
So 10th anniversary, big news for Bookmarks and the Festival of Books and Authors. What better way to begin than the huge superstar in the world of books, James Patterson?
Absolutely. We're so excited about him. I mean, he's someone, you know his name, but when you start looking at the statistics behind him, 1 in 4 books are James Patterson books that are being sold in 2011. He has the most New York Times bestsellers of any other author, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. I mean, it's amazing. And what I'm really excited about is that he is now writing not only for adults, these wonderful mystery thrillers, but he's also writing for middle schoolers and for teens. And so he'll be coming and speaking about writing in general, about his books, and really start out our festival weekend in the most perfect way possible.
James McBride is one of those authors that is just a fascinating kind of multi-talented threat, covers a lot of bases artistically for you all. Tell us a little bit about his background and how those experiences he's had wind their way into his writing.
Well, James McBride is so interesting to me because he's not only a writer, but he also has a background in music and in journalism. So he actually graduated with a master's at age 22 from Columbia University in New York. He studied composition at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. He has written songs. He's performed with musicians all over the world. So he has this wonderful combination of, you know, lyrical. When he's writing, you can tell that he's a musician as well. He first really, his landmark memoir, The Color of Water, going back to the New York Times bestseller list, was on it for 2 years. So that's a huge amount of time to be on there. And of course, Color of the Water was picked up by a variety of schools for freshman reads and things like that. And so the book that he's going to be touring with this year, for our festival, is The Good Lord Bird, which is a novel, but it's about the American Revolutionary John Brown. And again, I'm actually reading it right now. And as I'm reading it, I can hear that he's a musician as I hear the main character, whose name is Onion, speak and talk and relay his stories.
I guess Bookmarks always is kind of looking to expand its coverage in book-related fields. And one mm-hmm. of them this year is illustration. And I was excited to see a Hemingway on the list for this year's
Oh, my goodness. we are thrilled. So Edward Hemingway is amazing. He's an author as well as an illustrator. He's the one who's done our T-shirts this year, which we already have started getting to wear around town. And we're so excited. We have kids 6 months all the way up to 3XL, so everyone in the family can wear them. Edward has also written several books, illustrated several books, and the one that he is, we call it at home with my two-year-old, the Apple book, and it's called, his newest book is called Bad Apple's Perfect Day, and it's, and also you'll see that apple, that same apple on our T-shirts this year.
Fantastic. And we should say this is the grandson of the late, great Ernest Hemingway.
Absolutely.
Among others. Karen Abbott is another author visiting, and she's written about a whole host of fascinating subjects. And a new book keeps that tradition right alive there with Civil War Spies.
Yes, we're very excited about Karen Abbott. She is, again, another one of those New York Times bestsellers. But what is so interesting about her is that she's writing about true instances. So these are all nonfiction books that she's written. And her newest one is called Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. And it's a true story about four courageous women. And I think so often we see these, we have, like, for instance, a wonderful Pulitzer Prize winner who's speaking about history and about Wilson, our president, our former president. But then at the same time, we have Karen Abbott coming in and talking about maybe people that aren't mentioned in the history books. And so we're really excited to have her speak, as well as someone like Scott Berg, who will be speaking about our 28th president.
Bookmarks Executive Director Ginger Hendricks. Bookmarks Festival of Books and Authors, the largest book fest in all of North Carolina, folks, is September 6th, and it's free. There'll be several other events surrounding it, like the sale of all books now at the festival and at open houses on August 27th from 4:30 to 6:30. Bookmarks is at the corner of Spruce and 2nd Streets, directly across from the Haynes Brands Theater of the Milton Road Center for the Arts. There you can visit the office to get ready for the festival. All proceeds benefit Bookmarks and their many year-round literacy programs. Last year, Bookmarks reached 16,000 people in our community. You'll find a detailed listing of visiting authors at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Go grab your bag lunch and join me on the lawn, because it's time to go Out of the Bag with organizer Lynn Bird. Out of the Bag is an hour of lunchtime entertainment in downtown Winston-Salem's Winston Square Park every Tuesday at noon. It's an intimate, shaded venue where local writers, performers, and artists share their family-friendly work with live audience members who take an hour to kick back, enjoy their packed lunches, and some good free outdoor performances. Lynn Bird is a published author who sits on the Winston-Salem Writers Board. She, along with her friends at Recreation and Parks, Milton Road Center, and the Arts Council, recently resurrected this decades-old tradition, Out of the Bag.
I roll it out with introduction at noon, followed usually by the featured poet of the day. Then Cheryl talks about imagination, installation Imagine When. A musician might come up. They might play a 10-minute set to begin with, then another reader. Then the senior cheerleaders might come in. And there's a sometimes a weaver of soul crowns, these little great hats. He might be spinning yarn down there. And Bianca Williams from Sawtooth School may be throwing pots, you know, down there. You never know what you're going to see. And although I schedule these hours, there's some flexibility just in case somebody should walk up with an African drum and wants to get into some kind of goodness, some kind of rhythm on the stage. They're welcome to do that if the schedule permits.
That's a lot packed into an hour.
Yeah, there's a lot to fit into that hour. Gabrielle Sinclair and Ben Compton come from Greensboro because they love the whole concept. Gabby and Ben went to school in New York. Gabby's a screenwriter and also writes brilliant monologues. Grace Wynn Ellis writes, she's a playwright and poet, member of Winston-Salem Writers. She is one of our favorites, a crowd favorite. Nathan Ross Freeman and Authoring Action have been there, and they're frequent visitors, and they'll be back sometime in the middle of August. Sam Barbie, who is president of Winston-Salem Writers and poet held in high esteem in our state, he's won a lot of awards. He is always there and will jump in and fill any space. Dan O'Sullivan, also known as Dano, runs the open mic night for Winston-Salem Writers. He is basically our Speaker of the House. We love him. He's always there. Barry Howard is a vagabond musician who some people will have met at the Farmer's Market, Cobblestone Market. He plays there. He's absolutely wonderful. He's a blues musician. He plays his harmonica. He's a crowd favorite. The senior cheerleaders, my goodness, the cheering hearts. These women are all over the age of 60. They're probably all over the age of 70. I don't think anybody's 90, but I think there are a couple 80s in there. These women rock the crowd. They get in there with their bright neon pink tennis shoes and t-shirts and pom-poms and, you know, get the crowd going. We love them.
There are certain guidelines for the participating artists, and one of them is, this is not a chance for a long, angry rant.
That's correct. We love to keep things on the upbeat, on the positive, on the creative and inspiring. So we really don't embrace political rants or religious rants of any kind. We're non-denominational. We're diverse. People just want to have fun, relax, and listen to something inspiring.
Out of the Bag, Program Director Lynn Bird. OTB continues Tuesdays from noon to 1 through September 30th in Winston Square Park, located just above the Sawtooth School at the Milton Road Center between Marshall and Spruce Streets in downtown Winston-Salem. Anyone wishing to perform should contact Lynn directly, and you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. Our intern is Michaela Nance. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well, at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.